Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Kia ora koutou, ko Julie Ferry tuku ingoa, ko Puki Tapapa, Puki Wiwi, te maunga, ko te awanga, te awa, ko manakau te whanga. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, my name is Julie Ferry and I'm the Deputy Chair of the Puki Tapapa Local Board, one of five Rossville Community Voice reps on that board of Auckland Council and part of the City Vision Centre-Left whānau across the Isthmus. I have a regular spot here on Red Alert Radio. I'm very keen to get your feedback. You can find me easily on social media. Once you know how to spell my rather tricky last name, I'm on both Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Julie Ferry, that's spelled F for Fred, A-I-R-E-Y. We also have a Red Alert Radio Facebook page. Search for Red Alert Radio, aka, and you should find us. We put up links to the podcasts of these shows once they're up online, as well as other bits of useful, relevant news and information. You can get all of our past shows on the Red Alert Radio archive on planetaudio.org.nz as well. Now, today is part two of a two-part examination of the phenomenon known as bike lash. Last week, I talked with Jolisa Gracewood from Bike Auckland, and today I'm joined by Dr. Kirsty Wild, a sociologist and cycleway researcher and a research fellow at the University of Auckland. There's a current wave of anti-cycling sentiment that we're seeing both on the streets and in the papers. And there seems to be this trend of blaming cyclists and blaming investment in cycling, cycling infrastructure, those kinds of things, for what's sometimes quite unrelated traffic stress. Kirsty has proposed that this may actually be about a broader fear of change, and that's what we're going to be exploring more today. Thanks, Kirsty, for your time. Nice to have you on the line.
Oh, kia ora, thank you.
Now, first up, tell us a bit about your role as a sociologist and a cycleway researcher. How did that come about? How did you sort of end up doing this?
So as you said, I'm a sociologist. We're sort of the anthropologists that stay at home, that look at our own cultures and tend to have an interest in social change. I've sort of worked across community sectors. I worked in the ARC when it used to exist and in universities, and I have a particular interest in change making and in quality of life, so sort of how we get from A to B to improve quality of life in our cities. And I work in health, so when you work in health and you're interested in cities, it's sort of a no-brainer to get interested in cycling, because it's what they call a multiple satisfier. It just does so many things at once. It improves quality of life. It's also great in terms of improving the sustainability of your cities and good for economic efficiency as well. So, yeah, that's sort of what led me to cycling.
Multiple satisfier, that's a great term. I'm definitely going to use that again. Now, last week when I talked with Jolisa, we talked about some of the examples of local bike lash. So that's that sort of backlash against investment in cycling. Some of those examples are quite extreme, people occupying roadworks, smashing up curbs. You've spoken recently in the media about how you think some of this could be about a fear of change. Could you explain that idea some more?
Yeah, so I think in a way it's not so much fear of change. I mean, when we look at the community, there's a pretty even split about how people feel about change. I mean, there are people, probably tends to be in terms of their values, maybe a little bit more conservative, who are less excited about change. They also tend to be less excited about councils. So it's,
perfect storm.
And perhaps maybe a little more left-leaning. Actually have quite a desire for an interest in change. So it's not so much that, so everyone hates change, but the actual specific change that happens in a street associated with cycle lanes, I think, is probably just particularly stressful for drivers in particular, because the roadworks are just really quite extensive. Like, it's a really noticeable, annoying, disruptive change to your neighbourhood. And, drivers are the, motorists are the most stressed commuters.
Right.
Driving in and of itself is quite mentally challenging. You don't have good vision. You're going pretty fast and quite big object. I mean, it just requires a lot of concentration, and things that make the streetscape any more complex. People talk about how it looks cluttered now, or it feels cluttered now, in the same way that drivers tend to initially find it quite stressful to have new judder bars or cutouts that make you slow down, or all sorts of new signalling that we're putting on our roads, not just for cycleways, but signalling to slow down, to share, to, you know, all those things that just make driving feel more complex. They increase drivers' mental load at a time when we've already got congestion, which already makes people quite stressed out. So the combination of the disruption of the roadworks, really quite extensive roadworks often, and the adjustment stress, you know, just means that that whole process, rather than it necessarily being anything to do with cycling, is just a bit stressful for people. But I have to say that we do see other projects that have quite extensive roadworks involved that people are a little bit better about coping with, like when the lanes went in on Lake Road in Devonport, for instance.
Yeah.
They were also put in a median strip for ambulances because it's so congested that ambulances can't get down there. And people were kind of okay about the median strip and not okay about the cycle lanes. So there is an underlying issue with what they call social license, like how acceptable, how much disruption are we willing to put up with for this particular activity, which, you know, maybe we don't think is a massively high priority. So there are some issues around cycling in and of itself, but I think still a big chunk of it is that you've just got a particularly stressed out group, you know, having their lives made a little bit more challenging initially. Yeah.
It's really interesting because I know one of the issues with putting in, you know, particularly some of the traffic calming measures that you've talked about, I'm thinking about a car park that we redid down at Keith Hay Park in my area, and when we redid it, we made it much easier for cyclists and pedestrians to navigate, but we also consciously, well, I didn't, but the conscious part of the design was to get people to slow down because it's a car park that's used a lot by children. There's a lot of foot traffic. And interestingly, initially there was quite a negative reaction about that and people weren't slowing down. And that actually made it unsafe because they weren't slowing down. But that passed after people got used to it and realised this is not an environment where I can drive as fast as I used to. People got used to it and it's all settled, you know, it's actually settled down.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, the major reason why people get stressed about having to slow down with driving is that it's the mode, so drivers are the least satisfied of all commuters because they feel the least amount of control over their commute. They're so stop-start, they get held up, in inverted commas, by other cars. They're quite stressed about the fact that they find it difficult to get much flow and they feel out of control a lot of the time. So adding in stuff that slows them down even more tends to increase stress.
That's fascinating. Kind of,
we're in the transition phase, aren't we? Because it's just not safe to have people going at high speeds, you know, around our communities.
I find that we have
to put in new signals.
That issue about feeling a lack of control is really interesting because in a lot of ways you have the most control when you're on a bicycle, but you have a lot less control when you're on a bus or a train, but consciously give that away.
Right, but actually drivers feel even less control than people on a bus because they also have to concentrate much more as well. So it's even more stressful. But yes, sorry, you were saying.
No, well, my experience is I much prefer now to take public transport because I don't have to worry. You know, I give all of the control, but also all of the responsibility away. Whereas when I am in the car, you know, you feel like you should be in control and you're not able to be because of the circumstances. So I think that's really insightful. Thank you.
And actually in traffic research, we've seen so much in the past, there's been a lot of focus on people's decision making, Why do you decide to use this mode or that mode? But we're now starting to see a shift towards the focus on actually how those modes make us feel. And as soon as we saw that shift, you could see this quite big, you know, what they call cognitive dissonance when it comes to actually driving, because drivers often say, I make this decision because I feel in control. But when you actually look at how it makes them feel, they actually feel the most out of control.
I guess they have a higher expectation of control, and then when that expectation is not met, there's a bigger sort of gap, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah, and it also shows there's the most variation, I should say. There's the most variation within satisfaction of commute for motorists too, and I mean, that's kind of obvious, right? If you're driving in from Ponsonby, it's a lot different than if you're driving in from Albany. So, you know, some people have a lot more pleasant time in their car than others, But on the whole, they still feel even less in control than people who have to wait for a bus and,
Wow. So thinking about how that ties into the bike lash, is there sort of a bit of projection going on here where people's sense of frustration, and I guess the other thing I was thinking about when you were talking about roadworks, is they're visible. And one of the things that we talked about with Jolisa was there's been a lot of change in this city in the last 20 years, and for example, there's been a lot of infill housing. And now that's something that's often not very visible, because usually it's happening down a driveway and it's on somebody's property. Any inconvenience to you in terms of traffic or whatever will be relatively short-lived, whereas these roadworks are highly visible. And, you know, also cycling infrastructure is often highly visible, you know, particularly with the use of the green paint, the Kermit paint. We had an example in my area where an intersection was redone to make it safer for pedestrians. And one of the things they put in as part of that was the now standard green box that goes in front of the cars at traffic lights, so that cyclists have a stopping space, they can get to the front of the traffic. And as a result of that, one single piece of cycling infrastructure in this whole project, there was a constituent who was very concerned and thought that this was a cycling project, because that was the very visible change that he saw. So do you think some of it's, you know, projecting concerns, broader concerns, and then sort of picking the visible projects?
Well, I think people are looking for ways to express their anger about how stressful it is to get around, definitely. Yeah. I definitely think there's a little bit of, this is an opportunity for me to, you know, express how stressful this is, and this is a way for me to do it. I also think the way we're approaching cycle lanes, it is actually encouraging that a little bit, because we're treating them as a sort of optional extra. We're taking a sort of street-by-street approach. We're sending, and doing that, we kind of are sending out a signal that, you know, that it's okay to object to these things, you know. And we're sort of encouraging a sort of, you know, design-by-collective approach that we don't take with other basic safety infrastructure on our roads. We don't roll out a railway and say, you know, what do you think the angle should be on this bit of track?
Yeah.
You know? So the way that we're approaching it is sort of sending out a message that it's okay to say, I don't want this. And I think that we are really selling the whole city short by going for a sort of street-by-street approach. I think it encourages, it's divisive, yeah.
So one of the things I'm aware you've also published about is resilience, which, you know, it's a bit of a buzzword, and if you say resilience in Christchurch, they throw things at you. But that sort of, do you see issues with there being a lack of resilience possibly playing a role here?
I think probably the most obvious connection with my work on resilience is, I mean, I did research on resilience and ageing, and how we sort of create resilient cities when we've got an ageing population. When I think about resilience and cycling, I mean, we've sort of got to the point in our big cities where, you know, we've so run down our resilience resources, you know, to the point where we're barely able to function. But also, you know, we need to think about how it's affecting the resilience of our families and our communities that we've got such choked streets. You know, I think we need to be thinking of that broader issue of the resilience of our city once again, not just taking that very street by street approach. I mean, if I can use the example of Kay Road. You know, there's been some objection from retailers here, individual retailers who are worried about the impact on them of reduction in parking. But at the same time, I'm doing a project with ADHB, with the hospital. You know, the hospital's in a situation where they have got a massive increase in projected demand for their services, already got a massive shortage of parking. They've effectively got a scenario where you've got staff and patients having to fight it out for parking. Staff are taking 20 minutes to find a park to get into work. And we need to think about how that affects families in a scenario where they've got a sick child. I mean, someone wrote a good piece on the spin-off the other day, one there, excuse me, parenting journalist, and she talked about what it was like at Middlemore in that same situation where she had to drive around for half an hour and then piggyback her sick child in with her, you know. So I just think that we're sort of at that point where we're very much running down the resilience resources of our families and communities in our city by having such car-focused planning.
And I guess there's also that aspect of resilience that is sort of that providing a multiple modes so that if one mode is down, you've got other modes you can potentially shift to. And I guess, you know, you used the example before of an ambulance going in using a median strip on Lake Road. And I hadn't thought about median strips as having that purpose in the past, but that makes a lot of sense. But I wonder if in the future, you know, there have already been some attempts with paramedics on motorbikes and stuff where they can go through traffic and maybe we'll see similar on e-bikes in the future.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of, you know, of a multi-mode, having more options and resilience is London, actually. And when they had the tube bombings, they actually pushed a lot of people onto bikes.
Right.
So they could get around the city, even though a big part of the public transport system was effectively frozen. I mean, it's incredibly nimble, efficient, adaptable way to get around your city. You know, we're just not having to move so much bulk. Yeah, so they definitely increase the resilience of the city in times of crisis and shock, whether that's at the individual level in terms of, as you're talking about, getting to people, individuals when they need help, but just in general when you've got big infrastructure fails like the tubes going on strike or bombings or whatever.
And actually it was something that came up in my discussion with Jo Lisa, because when we were having that chat, the traffic was particularly bad that morning, and I was coming by car and she was coming by bike. And one of the points she made was being on the bike gave her a reliable travel time in that scenario, whereas for me there was a high level of uncertainty as to when I would arrive.
Yeah, so that's one of the major reasons why cyclists are the most satisfied commuters, because they have the best arrival time reliability, and particularly now with e-bikes. Because, you know, before in the past, you know, you might have got out of work and it might have been a bit windy and you're thinking, oh, you know, am I going to get to daycare in time to pick up my kid when you're on a bike? But now, you know, you absolutely can guarantee you're going to be there. Whereas as someone I was interviewing for one of my e-bike projects says, you know, if I'm in my car, I need to be like plus or minus, you know, half an hour. It could take me half an hour, it could take me an hour and a half, and it's just so stressful, particularly for women trying to manage, you know, having a job and having kids, and, you know, some men are in that situation too, but often a lot of women find the congestion just absolutely unbearable in terms of trying to manage home and work.
Now, thinking too about the predominantly women who are in the caregiving workforce, who sometimes are working shift jobs, so public transport isn't necessarily an option, and, you know, having to get from supporting clients, say, in the home, having to get from house to house, and the uncertainty of driving in that scenario as well. And again, that's something that has more of an impact on women, because often it's women they're looking after in the home as well.
Yeah, definitely congestion has more of an effect on women. They do, they also, just as I said, they do more what's called trip chaining. They have multiple trips, you know, and they're more bound by, they have, well, I shouldn't say bound by, but we tend to have multiple responsibilities.
Yeah,
that's the times where we have to be places.
That's a really interesting point. So you mentioned London a little earlier in terms of the resilience that their cycling system gave them in the context where the tube was unavailable. I was actually in London earlier this year and I had a little brief go on what they now affectionately call their Boris bikes. And yeah. I went on a short distance on one of their superhighways. Did they have bike lash when they were putting the stuff in? You know, did Copenhagen and Portland, did they have to deal with those kinds of issues as well? And is it something that just passes with time?
So most cities, when they try and put bike lanes in, get bike lash. So I should say that... there tend to be two aspects of bike lash. I mean, one we've talked a little bit about is that what we would call the sort of geographical community street by street sort of just disruption.
Yeah.
And then there's also the other part of it, which is what we call the sort of communities of interest or interest groups. There tends to be consistently a few particular groups who have quite a strong reaction to bike lanes. And in New Zealand, we particularly see that with retailers. There's also, bike lash can be a little bit partisan. If you vote a little bit more conservatively, you're more likely to object, to have a sort of values-based objection to bike lanes. And that primarily comes about because biking has been, like cycling has been an important, like kind of a symbol of something important and meaningful within a number of more leftist movements,
yeah.
Particularly environmentalism, in Europe, anarchism, but it has an association with being a lefty thing.
Yeah.
So there is a niche group of people, the Mike Hoskins of the world, who do quite strongly object to cycle lanes, you know, not just because it's disruptive, but because they see it as the sort of thing that doesn't fit with their values. So retailers, conservative, a small percentage of conservative voters. Overseas, we do get, they're two important interest groups in New Zealand object to bike lanes. Overseas, you do get some other groups as well. In places like London or Portland, you get what we would call sort of anti-gentrification objections. So quite often gentrification and cycle lanes happen at the same time.
Wow.
And for people who are being, it's not necessarily that one causes the other, but certainly people who are involved in gentrification often also like bikes and cycling. And you do get communities that, the sort of lower income communities that feel like they're being pushed out of their communities by gentrification, who attach that to bike lanes and quite strongly object. I mean, we saw that in London, we've seen that in the States a lot. We haven't seen that so much here yet, but I always flag it because it's definitely something for us to look out for.
Wow, that I hadn't considered that. And I think a lot of the work in New Zealand that I've seen has been around promoting cycling as a low-cost transport option too. So that's really interesting.
But it's kind of like, if you think of Auckland, like the CBD, you might need, so if you think about the cycling radius out from the CBD, I mean, it's changing with e-bikes, I would say that. It's changing with e-bikes, but the traditional radius is seen as about sort of, you know, between 3 to 5 Ks people might be willing to cycle. So if you go 3 to 5 Ks out from the CBD in Auckland, yes, you might be able to buy a bike for $500, but you're going to need $2 million to buy the house
live
and bike into town. So, this, you know, there's all those issues that get attached to cycling and those sorts of situations where lower income, more ethnically diverse communities are feeling pushed out. And New Zealand cycling tends to be something that Māori and Pākehā do at pretty similar levels. Pacifica people are not hugely into cycling. They don't learn to ride as often. Same with people of Asian descent. So we have a slightly different profile, ethnic profile, in terms of who's interested in cycling. We often like lump Māori and Pacifica together in terms of interests or experience. It's a little bit different in Auckland. But, you know, when we go, when we're planning for cycling in lower income, more ethnically diverse communities, which is definitely starting to happen in Auckland, I would expect that some of these issues come up, that cycling is like a white, wealthy person's thing. Because to a certain extent, it's at the moment, it's done by the absolute poorest of the poor and wealthier white people. So you're right that it is, like, it can be a way of addressing transport poverty. It isn't like that at the moment.
Yeah.
For the reasons that I've talked about, but there is an association with it being a white, wealthy person's thing. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Thanks. So, thinking about the, you know, sort of your key theory here about the impact of change and people's resistance to change is probably overstating it. Their concern about change.
Yeah.
And that often it's not really entirely about cycling. I'm thinking about, could this be playing out in other changes that council is rolling out? And like I've seen just recently, council's looking at a new waste collection system, and the big change that most people would experience is that you'll put your red bin, which is your landfill waste, out fortnightly instead of weekly. And a lot of people are just super, super upset by this, even though it seems like a relatively minor change and it's actually been signalled for quite a long time. And in my own community, I'm dealing with quite a lot of pushback about some new bus routes that are coming out in July. And, you know, a lot of consultation happened on this in 2015, and the implementation's been delayed, which has created some of the problem. But do you think that council can sort of learn from this? And I'm just conscious we haven't got a lot of time left, and I haven't left you a lot of time to answer, but what do you think?
I mean, I think that it'll be the worst with the transport projects because people are already so stressed out and they're looking for a place to direct that frustration and anger.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm surprised to hear that there's so much concern about the bins. But I think if I can just quickly say some things, some key principles in dealing with bike rash and how they might relate to other projects in
Great.
General. I think the minimising disruption thing with works is a really key issue and is still not being, you know, properly understood, I don't think. I mean, I know that roadworks take time in particular, but, you know, if they can fix that giant slip up in Northland by the weekend, then if you've got potentially controversial projects, having them take, you know, months and months and months is, you know, it's almost guaranteed to end in conflict. Pairing changes to other improvements that communities might want, you know, like that principle of if you put in a bike lane, also like improve the high street at the same time, like thinking about what other things in the community that people might want and try and pair them together. I don't specifically know how that would apply to the waste situation, but potentially could.
Yep, you got time for one more very quick.
The strongest amongst people are perhaps a little bit more conservative leaning. Think about how you're appealing to their values and particularly to family and to nostalgia. So and with cycling, it's focused less on the futuristic and more about bringing back things people love.
That's great.
You know, from their childhood or their younger years. I mean, you can see how that can apply to a lot of projects and how you actually market them.
Absolutely. Thinking about the old, bringing the old milk bottles back. Thanks so much, Kirsty, for talking with me today. That's been really useful. And if you missed part one of this with Jolisa Gracewood from Bike Auckland, you can find it online along with a lot of other episodes at planetaudio.org.nz. We're under R. Ka kite anō.
Together next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.